I think we'll get started. I just want to say on behalf of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, welcome and thanks for joining us today. The Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is pleased to host the Southeast Coastal Climate Network's webinar series. Today's webinar, the U.S. Southeast Ground Zero for Sea Level Rise. On behalf of SACE and Southeast Coastal Climate Network, I'd like to thank you again for attending. It is your interest and support that make our work possible. My name is Erin Cameron, and I will be the acting facilitator for today's webinar. I'd like to take a moment to review your control panel on your screen. All of our lines are muted right now and will remain so throughout the presentation. So we ask that you please chat in your questions using your control panel during the presentation. Your questions will then be fielded in the order they are received and will be answered at the end of the presentation. All materials for today's presentation will also be available on the SACE website at cleanenergy.org. I would like to now turn the presentation over to Chris Carnevale, SACE Coastal Climate and Energy Coordinator.
Thanks, Erin, and thank you everyone for attending the webinar today. My name is Chris Carnevale, and I'm the manager of the Southeast Coastal Climate Network. As you can see on the current slide, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is a coalition of individuals and organizations spanning the coastal Southeast who are working on coastal responses to climate change. We have members as far north as Maryland and as far west as Louisiana. The purpose of the network is to bring voices together, to trade information, and to synergize our efforts. The Southeast Coastal Climate Network is hosted under the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Our largest tool is our group site website, which is an online platform that enables members to send group emails, post discussion topics, or relevant news to discussion boards, and use a shared group calendar. If you're interested in joining the network and using these tools, please just visit the web address on the screen now, seccn.groupsite.com, and click Join This Group Now. For those of you on the webinar who are already members, I want to encourage you to use these tools to help get your message out. The purpose of the group is to encourage communication and collaboration, and you have a receptive group of people at your fingertips. So please don't be shy and use the web tools to your heart's content. Another great tool we have is our webinar series, of which today's webinar is a part. Today we're joined by Dr. Ben Strauss, Chief Operating Officer and Director of the Sea Level Rise Program at Climate Central. Dr. Ben Strauss serves as Chief Operating Officer and Director of the Program on Sea Level Rise at Climate Central. In the latter capacity, he has published multiple scientific papers, testified before the U.S. Senate, authored the Surging Seas Report, and led development of the SurgingSeas.org Coastal Flood Risk Tool, leading to front page coverage in the New York Times and Washington Post, appearances on the NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, and NPR national programming, and extensive coverage nationwide from AP, Reuters, Bloomberg, USA Today, and the LA Times, to many hundreds of local news outlets, to numerous editorials and op-eds. In earlier roles at Climate Central, Dr. Strauss served as interim executive director for 1 year, associate director and staff scientist. A founding board member of GRIST.org, he previously helped launch the Environmental Leadership Program. Prior to that, Dr. Strauss worked for ABT Associates, co-organized the Campus Earth Summit, and authored a report on college environmental education and practices for the Nathan Cummings Foundation. He holds a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from Princeton University, an MS in zoology from the University of Washington, and a BA in biology from Yale University. Ben?
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate having the opportunity to speak with this group, and hope what I share today is useful for the audience. I'm going to divide my talk into a few sections. I'm going to talk about our recent research findings that eventually prompted the coverage. Then I'd like to give a quick tour of our Sea Level Rise tool, which is really a zip lookup tool to investigate risks local to your area or places that you care about, and give a tour of our website as well, kind of graphics and features associated with the tool, and finally ask for some feedback and hopefully start a conversation about next directions that we could take. So there'll be a chance to brainstorm together at the end of this call. I hope that our continuing work will be able to serve members of the Southeast Coastal Climate Network and the Southern Alliance, and the kinds of people who I understand would might be joining this call. So let's see, I'm going to good hi to panel. So without further ado, also let me highlight my email on this opening screen. It's bstrauss@climatecentral.org. And I would be delighted to continue conversations with any participants on this call if you have questions later on down the road. Okay, so in mid-March, colleagues and I had two papers published in environmental research letters, peer-reviewed literature. One, the top shown here, really compiled a next generation of estimates of land, population, and housing vulnerable to sea level rise and flooding in the coastal U.S. Basically, a map of an assessment of the numbers of people living close to their local high tide line. So there was no time element. It was simply an assessment of vulnerability exposure. How many people and homes are just very very low in coastal regions. The second paper integrated global sea level rise projections with local trends to make local sea level rise projections around the U.S. It's actually the first paper to do this, and integrated those trends and projections of local sea level rise with patterns of storm surge to look at overall changes in flooding risk in these low coastal zones. So top paper is about making maps. The bottom paper is putting a timeline on the risk represented in those maps. We also created an online tool, click on your state or city or type in a county name or type in your zip code tool to let people see what this means for them. That was released on the same day as those papers were published. We timed it. And we were very gratified and humbled to see the media coverage that responded to those events together, and that Chris detailed in his introduction, his kind introduction of me. There's the article in the Times. So what did we, what were some of the headlines of what we found out? First, a tremendous amount of risk is concentrated in Florida. We all knew that, I think, intuitively, but this was the first work that placed it in a national context and compared Florida to the rest of the nation and allowed comparisons across any state. So this graphic illustrates the population living on land less than 4 feet above the local high tide line in each of the states depicted. The total for the contiguous U.S. is 4.9 million. So Florida eats up about half of that. Louisiana totals a little bit more than a million, about a million. The populations in other states are significant, but they're small relative to Florida. Here is a little bit more fine-grained detail of populations around the U.S., showing at the county level, the redder colors show higher levels of risk. So you can see Florida is very red and orange all around. You have pockets of, you have red and deep orange here around New Orleans and Louisiana. But there are other pockets of vulnerability as well. Here's my mouse. This is the county including Charleston, South Carolina. So there's a big concentration there. You can see moving up the coast a fair number of yellows and oranges. Here's Southeast Virginia, the Hampton Roads, Norfolk area. We've got the coastal counties of North Carolina that have become famous for this issue recently. Coastal New Jersey and New York, Long Island, have a lot of vulnerability, partly from being low-lying and partly because they have such high population densities. Now, we can also look, this image shows total population, total county populations under less than 4 feet above local high tide, but we can also look at the percentage of county populations less than 4 feet above high tide. And that presents a somewhat different picture. See here that Louisiana is relatively worse, so you have some less populated areas but with high percentages. In Louisiana, of course, a lot is protected by levees and people are living below high tide already. Florida, the biggest risk county by this metric is Monroe. Of course, the population is much less than Miami-Dade or Broward counties. And North Carolina pops up as the third really hot spot. Two of those 20 counties in the red zone here, plus some oranges and yellows and greens. So North Carolina is really number three in terms of counties with a high fraction of their populations living on very low land. And 4 feet is not far from the 39 inches that was the projection of the science panel in North Carolina for sea level rise this century. Here's another map that is basically the same kind of illustration as the last two slides, but for cities. This map shows includes a line for each of about 2,000 coastal towns and cities. The length of the line is proportional to the total population in the city, less than 4 feet above local high tide, and the color of the line is relates to the percentage. So the blues, dark, deeper blues, correspond to higher percentages. And it's not a linear scale for the nerds out there. So the long line should actually be a lot longer, but we had to transform the scale to make it fit on the map. And so again, you see Florida is a huge hotspot like Louisiana, but here are a couple of lines for Charleston and Mount Pleasant. Here you have Southeast Virginia, Hampton Roads, Norfolk, Virginia Beach, those kinds of places. New York City is this long white line, but we've got some bluer lines from communities in coastal New Jersey and Long Island. Just to look at lists of some of the top risk places, here are populations on land below feet, not including Florida, which has the most. But a handful of other states compared to Florida counties, and you can see that Miami-Dade and Broward counties have more people who qualify for this level of risk than every state in the United States except for Florida itself and Louisiana. And Lee and Pinellas counties in the west, near Tampa and south, are also extraordinarily vulnerable. They often get left out of the limelight that's pointed at southern Florida on this issue. But, you know, we talk about sea level rise risk to Virginia as being a serious challenge, and it is. Yet, here are two counties in western Florida, each with larger populations on very low-lying land. The sea is rising faster in Virginia, however. Here's another way to slice things for the top 20 cities by population, by total population on land below 4 feet. Florida has 14, Louisiana 3. And here's a count of cities and towns where more than 50% of the population lives on such low land. So you've got, and some of these can be very small towns ranging up to larger cities, 106 in Florida, 65 in Louisiana, but 14 in Virginia. Oh, I left out a number in North Carolina. It's 22, I believe. Significant numbers in other states as well throughout the Southeast. None for Mississippi or Alabama, so they're not here. So that's a quick tour of the results, of our main results, and what they mean for the Southeast and how the Southeast compares with the rest of the nation. I'll say of the top 10 states, there are 22 coastal states in the lower 48. Out of the top 10, 6 are in the Southeast. So it really is where the concentration of population on low land is. We've got a lot more findings. You really can extract statistics, you know, for your own needs and communications purposes, planning purposes, from data we have on our website and reports, and our tool, which I'll now show you, and customize it, you know, as locally as you like. So at the same time we published these papers, we published this online Surging Seas tool. You can get there at sealevel.climatecentral.org or simply surgingseas.org. We'll redirect it. Type in a zip code and go, or navigate by state or city. Here's an example. This is the Tampa-St. Petersburg area showing land less than 4 feet above local high tide line. Here we go. Got a water level slider you can adjust here. And the dark satellite photo areas with the blue boundaries show land less than this elevation. So basically the tool reveals and makes more visible the area that's at risk instead of covering it up. The whites and the grays are for land above the elevation. It's important to be clear, and the notes on the site explain this as well, that these maps show land below a certain elevation. They don't guarantee a flood, but they're showing vulnerable, exposed areas. You'll see you have a lot of information you can get on the left-hand panel of the tool. For example, here are some statistics for plus 4 feet for St. Petersburg, population, homes, and acres by total and percent. There are a lot of useful links. You can download this data. We'll get to that in a second. Jump to a Florida map or a fact sheet with details for the whole state, or a list of adaptation plans in Florida. Our overall Surging Seas report, which is the best place to get the picture in layman's terms as opposed to our scientific papers, which are also freely available online, and a number of other functions. So speaking of data download, you can click there and get the raw data for St. Petersburg. In this case, here's a screenshot of the Excel file, and for 1 through 10 feet above local high tide, we present total and percentages for population, housing, total land, and dry land, which doesn't include lakes or freshwater wetland. You can go into cities list mode on the tool by clicking cities at the top. You can do the same thing for counties, and it shows within the map extent the list of cities. You can rank them by the variable of your choice, your population. We have data that lets you do the same kind of thing. So here we're ranking Florida cities by population less than 4 feet, I believe. You can click on a water level station, which water level stations are marked by these blue bubbles with decades in them. And the decade indicated in the water level bubble shows you that we choose a decade such that it's the closest decade to the present, where there's an over 1 in 6 chance that a combination of sea level rise, storm surge, and tide will reach up to the water level that you, the user, sets at this site. So these flood risk indicator sites, or water level stations, they correspond to 55 study sites we used in the second of our two papers. Now, there is more detailed data available to download if you click on the station data download here, that gives you basically for each elevation above local high tide, the percent chance of water overtopping that level by a decade. So this is that timeline of risk. And the analysis really is strictly at the points of these water level stations. We have not yet done an analysis of exactly what that means for neighboring areas. I think the answer is that in some case, those numbers will have a lot of meaning for wide areas, and in other cases, there will be different patterns of flooding over very small distances, and that's the subject of some future work we're hoping to develop. But for now, we feel that these are useful indicators of exposure or risk for the general areas. So here's a quick tour of just a few other places. Here's a look at Charleston. Land less than 5 feet above high tide. Here's Norfolk, Virginia Beach area. And you see more water level station bubbles. Here's a closer zoom on the left here in Norfolk. All of these piers sticking out, I think, are part of the world's largest naval base here. Here's a closer zoom just to show you that this tool lets you zoom right in to be able to see block by block and get a detailed map also in the Norfolk area. So now let me give a quick tour around the site. We've got a maps section, which lets you access the tool I just showed you, but we have a variety of other maps, which are all freely republishable, reusable. One connects to a report we did on energy facilities at risk and was the subject of some Senate testimony. A series show how global warming is changing the risk of extreme coastal floods in a very short time frame. We basically compared the risk of getting a century flood by 2030 with our sea level rise projections versus a scenario where there were no global sea level rise, either in the future between now and 2030 or in the past. So, we're showing here a risk by 2030 in the red with sea level rise from global warming, the blue without sea level rise from global warming. So we're only taking out the global warming part. If the land is also sinking, like in Virginia, we leave that in. So the blue columns take that into account. And the sea is still rising, just slower than it would be when you add climate change as well. And you can see that in some places, global warming is making a huge difference in the risk of these extreme floods by 2030, like northern Florida, and it's almost tripling it in the Keys in southern Florida, smaller changes on the west coast. Yes, I wanted to highlight that all of these graphics are republishable embeddable, you know, broadcastable. Moving up the coast, you can see really strong influences continuing in Georgia, South Carolina, you know, odds more than tripled at Savannah and Myrtle Beach, almost tripled at Cape Fear in North Carolina, and again, more than tripled at Norfolk, just from the global warming component. We've got another section that we call Activate. There, it includes opportunities. I won't show you this page, but to share your own stories of coastal flooding or photographs, we'd be very grateful if anyone on this call, you know, has stories to share, to send them our way. For you, we have getting widgets, clicking through there. The top two widgets here on the left are ways for you to embed our Sea Level Rise tool on your web page or blog, wherever you want. These are kind of larger format, so people can move through the map right there on your site. Then we've got a very small footprint, flexible footprint, simple city-state or zip lookup that would send people to our site once they look up their zip. And then we have a personal sea level rise calculator, which is something else I'd like to draw to your attention. We jump in here. The photograph on this slide is of a girl standing in a mid-range projection of sea level rise expected during her lifetime. And we have developed a tool using our peer-reviewed research that lets you type in your age or a friend's gender and zip code, as well as an emissions scenario, and get a lifetime sea level rise projection out. So, you know, we basically use government tables to see life expectancy of someone of an age and gender, and then we match that up against our local sea level rise projections under different scenarios to give you an answer. And then, it personalizes it, and you can take a photo of a friend, a child, yourself, a parent, standing in water that deep. Instead of talking about the year 2080, you can make it very personal, like this photograph. And you can also really see the generational issues that climate change and sea level rise represent when you compare images of photographs of children versus adults or grandparents. So this is a campaign. It's a communications idea that we are just experimenting with and thinking about right now and interested in figuring out a way to develop it rather more substantially. So very much encourage experimentation ideas. If anyone on this call is interested, we'd love for you to use the tool on our site, embed the widget, think of ways to use it. We have a shortcut link, simply surgingseas.org/calculator. There's a closer look at that. This image is somewhat spooky, but you can do all kinds of things. People can have different expressions, hold up signs, you name it. Another part of the site, briefly, is responses. So we've been compiling state plans and initiatives, more local plans and initiatives, and so that we're presenting the efforts being made to think about this and solve the problem, as well as simply the vulnerability. There's a section for research on the site, so if you want to get deeper into what's behind the infographics and maps and numbers, that includes reports for a more general audience, and the reports include state-by-state fact sheets, which might be useful. Here's the list of states and just the top bit of an example for North Carolina. So we include lots of handy statistics and facts for each state one at a time. I encourage folks to look at the main report. Tables 1 and 2 in this report have a lot of great information on local sea level rise projections by 2030, by 2050, and the odds of historic floods or floods to 4 feet or 5 feet above local sea level rise, and how much global warming has multiplied the odds of those floods. So finally, I'd like to share some of our future plans. And when we move into the discussion section of the call, I would love to have your questions about our findings, methods, experience, everything, our tool, everything I've just showed you. And I hope we'll also get into some discussion. I'd love to have some feedback on how we might improve and expand upon what we've done. So the first thing that we're doing is we're going to be updating the map itself to reflect the next generation of elevation data. The research that came out in March was based on something called NED, or the National Elevation Dataset, which is still the best nationwide, nationally available elevation data for coastal areas. But LIDAR data, elevation data measured by laser from airplane overflight, is more accurate and quickly coming online. So over the next couple of years, we'll be updating the site to reflect LIDAR data. And you know, the numbers in our analysis and the particular map layouts will adjust a little bit as a result. But something else but there are a number of other things we plan to do that are perhaps easiest to explain with a couple of graphics. One is to expand our analyses from, you know, currently we have area and population and housing, but we plan to expand our analysis to include the socially most vulnerable population as a subset of the population and intersect that group with risk from sea level rise. Property value exposed in low-lying areas, the number of schools exposed, the number of wastewater treatment plants, and a whole host of different point features, EPA sites, energy facilities. I've already shown in an earlier slide how we did an analysis with energy facilities. So we plan to do a great number of these things and of these analyses. And one of the things I would love to hear from the audience on this call is what kinds of features would be most useful from your perspective. And when I say useful, I think of that in two ways. One is for direct planning purposes. You know, how many hospitals are in flood-prone, low-lying areas. Another reason, though, is for communication or persuasion purposes. If you're trying education purposes, if you're trying to educate constituents or supervisors or colleagues, what kind of facilities, what kind of information will be important for them? A second dimension of what we are planning to do on a nationwide basis, this map, this slide illustrates just Florida, and I've shaded in a random way, more or less, Florida counties. So it doesn't really correspond to the area below 4 feet, but this is a more standard infographic, right? We're imagining, we're looking at the blue shade indicates how much of the county's area is below 4 feet. And we're imagining a parallel tool here. Think of it as a data navigator that lets you quickly move through the data, and then you, let's see if I've, well, I put it on this. You can click on your Go to Flood Map button to jump into our main map tool. But here, you know, we're showing counties as a unit over which analysis was done. And in our current map tool, we compute statistics for counties. We also run statistics for cities, and that's it. But moving forward, we're interested in developing totals by zip code, developing totals by congressional district or state legislative districts, by management areas, special planning districts, all kinds of areas, units within states. And again, the question is, you know, what was useful from a practical practitioner point of view in actual planning, and what's useful from a communications point of view as you think about reaching out to colleagues, supervisors, and constituents. So I'd also be grateful for thoughts about what, you know, what kinds of units, spatial units, would be best for us to focus on, because there's a fair amount of computing involved as we'll be doing this nationwide, you know, how to prioritize what would be most useful. But, you know, we can even go down to wards or school districts, you know, even small units within counties or cities are possibilities. And, you know, one will be able to navigate through this tool by clicking on a county and seeing what's beneath that and so forth and so on. And have extensive data download capability. Here's just one more image, displaying by threshold instead of ranking, which I think is often more useful because, well, we have a tendency not to worry if we're not number one or two on the list, but actually probably should be worried if we're above a well-chosen threshold, and that's usually a larger set of areas. So that's it for my main slide presentation. I have four more slides that are just a kind of a thought-provoking teaser, but I think it's probably best now to go to conversation, and if we have time at the end, and if that works, I'll go back to those last few slides to tie things up. I will.
We do have some questions. Do you want me to read those for you first?
Terrific.
Okay. Can you explain why sea levels are rising at different rates at different points along the coast?
Great question. So there are many factors that go into sea level rise. The sea level that we're talking about is how sea level is changing relative to land. If you're standing on the shore or holding a measuring stick, how sea level is changing right where you are. And if you stop to think of it, sea level could change there for two basic reasons. One, the water is rising. Two, the land is sinking. So, in fact, the land is sinking along the coast of much of the lower 48 states. It's rising in a couple of places. And that varies from place to place. So that leads to different rates of sea level rise. And that's the most important factor that leads to different rates in different places. Just briefly, the most important thing behind, the most important force behind this has to do with the retreat of glaciers from the last ice age, which used to cover most of Canada and down a little to the United States. Those glaciers were really heavy, and pushed down the land underneath them. So when the glaciers retreated, the land that used to be underneath is springing back up. So that land is rising. But if you think about it like sitting on a mattress, when you sit on a mattress, the mattress underneath you compresses, and when you stand up, it comes back up, it springs back up. That's easy. But if you think a little more, when you sit on a mattress, the part that's not underneath you actually lifts up like a seesaw. And when you stand up, it goes back down. And that going back down is happening really throughout almost all of the lower 48 states, but it's in different rates in different places, and the fastest rates are in the mid-Atlantic. Now, the Chesapeake Bay area has another problem, which is that there's an impact crater under the water from an ancient asteroid that's causing land to sink even faster there. And then there's a third factor, call it a triple whammy, for the northeast U.S., but really from Cape Hatteras through Boston, which is climate models have predicted for years now that warming will slow down the Gulf Stream and currents underneath it, moving north across the Atlantic. And that slowing down, the ocean is not flat, just like a stream is not flat. When you have winds and currents, the water surface is not flat. A slowing down Gulf Stream basically leads to a traffic jam that piles up more water in this North Carolina to Massachusetts zone. And that area is projected to get an extra 6 to 10 or 12 inches of sea level rise this century because of that. And a paper that just came out about a month ago and got a lot of media coverage about this sea level rise hotspot in the Northeast was the first paper to detect, extra acceleration of sea level rise in the Northeast. And it's strong supporting evidence, a kind of a fingerprint that matches what the climate models have been predicting. So I didn't even talk about all of that stuff is on top of global sea level rise. A final factor is that water expands as it heats, and it heats unevenly. So it gets warmer more in some places than others, so that leads to more sea level rise in those places where it's getting warmer. So it is a bit complicated, but in the long run, the global component is, the global average sea level rise change is going to be the largest term. But right now, the contribution from sinking land, so far is still quite important, about, say, half of the sea level rise in New York over the last century and more in Virginia and Louisiana, for example, where the delta sediments are sinking and where oil and gas extraction have actually reduced pressure subterraneanly and the land is compacting. So that's enough, but you can see that there are a lot of different local factors.
Great. Thanks, Ben. We have another question. Are you working with local municipalities and their GIS departments sharing data and assessing their capabilities of utilizing these tools?
So unfortunately, I'm going to offer a much shorter answer this time. Not yet. No. We are really just getting out the word now. So we'd be delighted to be connected for your help in bringing this to local municipalities' attentions. Some have enough resources to do it on their own, like New York City and maybe the four South Florida counties, but a lot of places with fewer resources and smaller areas, we'd be delighted to bring this to their attention.
Okay. We had a few questions that were related to that question, so you answered those. And I think now we could go ahead and open this for discussion. I just want to let the attendees know that we want you to be an active part of this part of the presentation. So in order to unmute yourself, because we've all been muted, you just need to hit star 6. And so if you'd like to participate or give Ben some feedback, go ahead and hit star 6 to unmute yourself. And then when you're done speaking, hit star 6 to mute yourself again. Okay, go ahead, Ben.
All right, terrific. Thanks so much, Erin. So I guess I'd be really interested from this group to learn whether there are particular kinds of facilities that you would like to see us map, or whether there are particular kinds of administrative units, management units, that you'd like to see us compute statistics over. Or if you have other feedback on our existing tool or other ideas about how we can improve the tool, the user experience, or do analysis to be more helpful.
Is it question
time? Hey,
Ben,
Chris Carnevale here. The only thing that really popped out to me just right off the bat here is on the Surging Seas city by city or county by county tool, if you could make the probability of flood risk a variable so that you could actually change that so it wasn't just set at 1 in 6, but if you could change it, 1 in 6, 1 in 3, 1 in 2, whatever, I think that could be an interesting feature. Not a deal breaker because you already have such an awesome tool here, but that could improve usability somewhat.
Terrific. That's a great idea.
I had a question about the 39 inches of sea level rise predicted.
Yeah.
Because it seems like that's not a number. I mean, if you kind of Google the question of estimates of sea level rise, that sounds higher than earlier estimates for this century. And then the other question I have is, in talking to people, I mean, I'm living on the coast of Florida, very close to Fort Lauderdale Beach, and people read all the time about glaciers melting, lack of sea ice in the poles, but also vast amounts of perched ice, and Greenland melting, and Antarctica, and people aren't seeing anything. So the public is reading about these things, and yet people who live on the coast are not seeing any kind of an incremental shift in their experience of the flooding that's supposed to be taking place. So we're talking about 39 inches within the century, and yet people are seeing or reading about the vast sheets of ice melting, and yet not seeing anything. I'm just wondering how you present that.
Yeah. Great question. First I'll say that 39 inches, which is basically 1 meter, translated
right
into inches, is a pretty mainstream scientific projection today. But it is higher than what the IPCC projected in 2007. And those numbers have circulated, very widely with good reason. The problem is there's been a lot of updates since then. If you read the IPCC report closely, you'll see that they have an asterisk on their projections to say they left out ice sheet dynamics, which, well, it's a fancy term, but it's the most important term of all. Just to kind of put that in perspective, we right now estimate that there are between 1 and 2 feet of total sea level rise potential for all of eternity frozen in the world's small glaciers, mountain glaciers, 1 to 2 feet total. Also, most estimates show, not more than 1 foot of sea level rise per century from what's called thermal expansion, which is the ocean gets warmer, and so it expands, and you get sea level rise. And So we got 1 foot per century on the one hand, and you've got 1 to 2 feet total for all time on the other. Those two elements, the IPCC estimates modeled and incorporate, but what they basically left out was the third factor, which is the great ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica. Now, what's the total potential sea level rise from those ice sheets? 200 feet.
Right.
So, you can't really take that projection too seriously when it leaves out that term. And the reason it left it out was because we're just not very good. You know, we don't understand the details of ice sheet dynamics yet. It's been really hard to work out scientifically. But through a variety of statistical, there are some new statistical approaches that basically say we don't need to know the details. Like, let's look at the historic relationship between temperature and the rate of sea level rise and project that forward. And that family of projections basically gives you answers between 2 and 6 feet by the end of the century. So 3 feet is a kind of lowish end consensus. Now, as you know, it's hard to describe how much massive ice there really is. So even though a chunk of ice the size of Manhattan falling off of Greenland is, you know, unusual and sounds dramatic, it's still a drop in the bucket. You know, it's our projections suggest we might see 0.5 foot over the next 20 years. So for a lot of people, that will be below what they notice on a year-to-year basis. The way sea level rise is manifesting itself is more and more floods coming higher and higher. You know, I guess final thought is, you know, so, and people will think of that often as a flood as opposed to sea level rise. But something very important to remember, I think a really key point that we're almost all missing, is that we have already had 8 inches of sea level rise from global warming over the last century. So what does that mean? That means that every single coastal flood today is about 8 inches higher than it would have been without warming. So, you know, if 5 inches of water flood into your living room because a big storm came through, and you know, you feel like you got whacked by Tropical Storm Debbie because a surge came through and you had 5 inches of water, well, guess what? Like, you might not have had any water coming in if we hadn't had that sea level rise already. We're already in the middle of it.
Okay, thanks.
This is Rhonda Ruff. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was on mute or not. Kind of following what you were just talking about the floods and the impact on people, I haven't explored around your website really thoroughly, but there are aspects of livability that concern me, like saltwater intrusion. Does your website or does the data somehow assess livability of areas as well as just water height? For example, South Florida, we're dependent on groundwater resources for our drinking uses. And
yes,
it'll take time for that salt to get in, certainly, but it will get there eventually. Is that incorporated in there?
It is not. That's a higher level of detail. You might look to the South Florida Water Management District. I know that they're working on analyses on around that problem.
And that actually leads me to the next part of my question. This is regarding Everglades restoration, like a big hot topic in natural resource management. One of the thoughts is, and the reason that a lot of Everglades restoration funding is continuing is because we believe that sending enough water south will sort of buy us some time to maybe migrate, for the species to migrate, for the natural resources, for the, you know, plants and animals,
yeah,
to migrate, for people to migrate. And then there's going to be this competition for livable places. we're working to preserve wildlife corridors, because if all the people move into the high places, then where are the animals going to go and all the plants?
Yeah.
So for natural resource management combined with human needs, I was just curious about, you know, your take on that or your focus on any of that.
Well, I have, you know, it's not my specific expertise, but I have heard it said, I have heard of, you know, increasing flow in the Everglades as one strategy to retard saltwater intrusion in South Florida. I don't know the details or the merits, but, you know, I agree that there's South Florida real estate is going to be shrinking. And, I mean, real estate in the broadest sense, like land available. And, you know, we already have a situation where there's a lot of conflict between human development and natural habitat, and I'm afraid that that will only be aggravated. You know, one thing to bear in mind is that saltwater, you know, wetlands, marshes, beaches, dunes, all of these make really valuable soft defenses against storm surge and floods that dissipate a lot of the energy and damage potential. So I think that's important to keep in mind and, you know, to bring into all of the discussions about what the land use is going to look like as the land shrinks.
Okay, everyone, I think we're getting pretty close to the end of the hour, so unfortunately we're going to have to wrap up. But, Ben, is it okay if everyone contacts you if they have any additional feedback?
Absolutely. I'd be very grateful for any feedback on the tool, the site, analyses, facilities that you'd like to see done moving forward. Again, my email is bstrauss, B-S-T-R-A-U-S-S, at climatecentral.org. And I'll leave you with this quick thought. This is the land less than 25 feet above high tide line. Here's a closer
Sorry,
look.
I switched it to my screen. Hold on one second.
Oh.
Hold on.
Okay. Sorry. Oops. Let's get back. Okay. This is the land less than 25 feet above local high tide for the United States. A zoom in for the southeast. 125,000 years ago, during the last warm period before the last ice age, global temperatures were about the same as now, maybe a degree warmer. We're almost certainly headed towards warmer temperatures this century, but sea levels then were about 25 feet higher than today. So this is where the long-term arrow may well be pointed. That's some of our best evidence. And when, now how long could that take? Well, 250, we look back to 250 years ago, heroic images. We still remember that time. I would put 250 years as the very, very fast end of the spectrum. But there is precedent for sea level rise that fast within the last 20,000 years. As we came out of the last ice age, a foot a decade for about two or three centuries. 500 years ago, Columbus arriving. If we end up with about 3-4 feet of sea level rise this century, this is the pace we'll be on, about a five-century pace, if the trajectory points us through 25 feet. We remember these times, the times of the Founding Fathers and Columbus, are times that are in our, they're vivid in our cultural memory. We remember them as heroic times. So the question is how people will remember us when they look back 250 years into the past or 500 years into the past in the future, how our descendants will remember. And, you know, I think we have the chance to make a very big difference in the outcome depending on our actions over the next few years, decade, few decades. So thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, everyone, for interacting. That was really great. That was pretty new for our webinar series to have the discussion open, and and that was a nice added bonus. So thank you. And I just wanted to say that SACE is very excited to have a part in hosting this webinar series. We'd like to thank all of our members on this call and encourage those of you who are not members to join us today. For more information, please check out our website at www.cleanenergy.org. And I encourage you also to view our blog or follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, today's presentation will be available on the SACE webinar archive page of our website. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.